Hello, it's quite early, so I will start directly with the talk. I mean, you can see the title. I'm working on the continuum limit of spin foams. And let's see an overview first, where I'm going to describe exactly what we're going to, what we try to do. So we try to solve, like, this is an overview of the talk in general of the project. Okay, a bit louder. Maybe I can move it a bit. Is it better now? Okay, so our aim was to solve the spin foams. There are actually two ways to solve it. I'm going to give more more details in a bit. So just stick to this overview. So we can use the so-called Lebansky action. It's more like a continuous way to solve the spin foams. And there is, and Bianca is working with Johanna in that. But here in this talk, we're going to talk about the discretization procedure. So what we're going to do is find the semi-classical limit of spin foams, which is connected to area edge action. Then we are going to implement this on a lattice. And there are a lot of calculations that took place, which I'm not going to go really deep into. Then find the continuum limit of this discretization. There are, again, a lot of calculations that I skipped. And then finally, let's see, that does it connect to GR in then or not? That's the most important part. Okay, so I don't consider it an introduction, actually. It's more like to give you the context of what I'm working on. So there is loop quantum gravity, which is a leading candidate of a quantum description of space-time. They try to find the quantum geometry of space-time. And the nice feature with this theory is that its dynamics can be consistently defined on a microscopic level. So now the question that arises is that, can we actually find a way to move from the microscopic level to the macroscopic level? How are these two connected? I mean, first of all, are they connected? And then second, how? So spin foams is actually the configuration of the quantum geometry of space-time, and we can use them to define the path integral formulation of LQG. I know that it's too fast, but I don't have the time, unfortunately, to give an introduction in LQG and also the talk. So I'm going to give you this really small introduction. Now, what we know from the literature is that the semi-classical limit of spin foams, as we said earlier, is connected to the area edge action, which is what we're going to mainly do in this presentation. So let's start with a bit of the length edge action. So it is a well-established approximation of the Einstein-Hilbert action. So it's a way to use to define the continuous GR in a discretized space-time. It actually uses triangulation. So instead of the usual lattice, we're going to use triangulation. I'm going to talk about that in a bit. The most important part that I want you to remember from this one is that this is how it is defined. It's pretty easy. So we have the areas of the triangles. So as I told you, we use triangulations. So just imagine, like, when you have a triangle, you have the areas of the triangles and the length of the edges. Okay? So in the length edge action, the variables of the theory are these length variables here. Okay, it's really important to remember that. So these are the areas of the triangles. And this is a really important angle that we're going to use also later. Unfortunately, I don't think I have the time to go really into the geometry of that and see, like, try to show to you what each term means in the geometrical sense. But just stick with me, and you need to believe for now that this epsilon is measures curvature. So just imagine it's like how to connect two triangles, and like depending on how they are connected with each other, they give a sense of the curvature of the space-time. Now, as we said earlier, we're working on triangulated manifold. So, but not a regular lattice as QCD. So I don't know if you are familiar with, but in QCD they define a regular lattice like a cube, for example, and then that's how they do the calculations. In our way, we don't actually use the cube itself, but actually like the triangles that we define connecting the vertices of the of the cube. So in a four-dimensional case, which is, makes it even worse than this, like, I mean, I can understand that this doesn't mean anything to you. So just imagine that we are going to the 4D case. And in the 4D case, we have like 10 edges for a so-called 5-cell. We're going to call it a tridron here. It's not the correct definition, but we use that in the paper. So we're going to continue with that, okay? So technically it's a 5-cell. It's the analog of a four cube in the sorry of the cube in four dimensions. So when you stick two simplices, that means like two 3D cubes together, then we end up with 14 left variables. Okay, it's going to be a bit better later. So stick with me for a bit. So now we go to the area rejection, which is completely different than the previous one, because the variables are now the areas. Apart from that, it's exactly the same action, like really nothing changes. So here you can see, for example, before we had a dependence on the left, here we only have areas. Nothing really changes. Now, I'm lying a bit, because there is actually something that changes, and it is really important to keep in mind for later. So now we said before that this angle actually measures the curvature of space-time, of our space-time. This doesn't happen in area rejection. And this was a problem that actually was considered to be a problem for area rejection all this time. So it actually measures a mixture of curvature and shape mismatch. Okay, keep that in mind. We're going to see that in the end. So it's really important to remember here that although the action and the definitions are the same, the variables now are not the lengths of the edges in a triangle, but rather the areas, and that this angle no longer means just curvature. Okay, it's really important to remember that. Again, in the 4D case, we have 10 areas on a four simplex, and we stick two of them together, then we have 16 area variables. If you remember before, in the case of the length variables, we only had 14. So what this means is that if we try to go from the length to the area variables, like if we try to define the Jacobian, we have additional degrees of freedom in the area rejection. So that gives us a problem of how to define the dynamics. And this is the second thing I want to remember for the end. So the first thing is that the angles do no longer just mean curvature. And the second one is that the Jacobian, like transforming from the set of lengths as variables to the set of areas as variables, leads sometimes to degenerate matrices, to singular matrices. Okay. Now, let's go actually to the calculations. I think I have some time to ask you if you have an overview of what we are trying to do. Is it okay? No question. I mean, if you have questions, you can ask me at any point. So we're working on a flat Euclidean for this spacetime, and we need to define a triangulation. In our project, we didn't use a dynamic triangulation or anything. We just defined the regular lattice, like a cube, basically. And then we find a way to triangulate this cube. Nothing really fancy here. Now, in the previous work by Bianca, you define just the regular hypercubic lattice with this lattice vector. And this lead to these so-called hypercubical constraints, which are connected to the Jacobian that we said that is singular before. Okay? So now the question is, can we avoid this problem? Can we do something to avoid this degeneracy of the Jacobian? We actually came up with this solution. So instead of having the usual regular lattice, we add an inner vertex on it. So just imagine, it's difficult, but a 4D cube and then an inner vertex in the center of it. And this actually turns the Jacobian in a non-singular state. So we can actually invert it. So that means we can go really easily from the length variables to the area variables. Remember that spin forms are connected to area variables. That's why we actually want the area rejection calculus. Okay, I'm going to repeat these things a lot of times so that we actually remember what's happening. Now, we need to define the lattice Fourier transform. And we were based on a previous work. And so we needed to, the previous work defined the Fourier transform only on the boundary of the hypercube. What this means is that we need to find a way to integrate out this bulk variable. So we split the variables into, the variables are now areas. Okay? So we split the variables into the boundary terms. That means the ones that are not connected to the inner vertex, and the bulk ones, which are the ones that are connected to the inner vertex. And we managed to integrate the latter out. So what we actually did is that we refined our previous triangulation. So we added an inner vertex, refined our triangulation, inverted the Jacobian and then integrated out the inner part, and we ended up with something analog to the original triangulation that was not working. Okay. Now, the question is, does it give something more than the previous calculation? I mean, first of all, it made the calculations possible without the hypercubical constraint, so it's a nice step, but does it actually lead to something? Let's see. So we do the Fourier transform, we expand, I mean, these were literally a lot of technical details that I decided to leave out of the talk. So what is important here is that we are doing the Fourier transform, we're going to get coefficients for each term, and then we, in terms of the lattice constant, and then we can expand it, and we went to a derivative expansion of the Hessian. The Hessian is like the coming from the action, the area edge action that I showed in the beginning. Now, as we said, we are working with areas. So the question is now to connect, can we connect it to GR somehow? Can we connect it to a continuous manifold? There is, in the literature, the so-called area metric. I mean, we know from GR that the usual procedure is to have like a metric which takes and sinks to two lengths and gives back the distance. Yeah. So now what we're trying to find a metric which actually takes a sinks to areas. So we try to connect it with the formulation of GR, where the basic variables instead of the lengths are the areas. In order to do that, the areas need to take as input like areas of parallelograms. So if you remember, we had as variables, we had triangles. So what this means is that we need to glue two triangles together, define planes. So we define two sets of variables, which are the A plus sector, which actually measures a parallelogram, gluing two triangles together. And there is the A minus sector, which I don't think we have, at least for now, a valid interpretation in geometrical sense, like what this means in geometry. Okay, but anyway, like most of the dynamics come from the A plus sector. So I again omitted a lot of calculations, but yeah, we need to identify the length degrees of freedom, and then I'm not going to spend too much time on it, and then find the lowest order correction in the effective action from these fluctuations. Okay, skipping all that, let's go to results. Like, what did this project lead to? So first of all, we managed to recover GR in the leading order. So we managed to show that if you take the spin forms, which is like a quantum description of spacetime, and you try to find the semi-classical limit, do this triangulation part, okay, the calculations, and then find the continuum limit of that, we end up with GR in the leading order. And in the lowest order correction, we get something that is proportional to the Weyl square tensor. So why are these results interesting? It's a really important thing to see. Until now, there was not any calculation concerning spin forms and how the semi-classical limit would be. So there were some speculation, but no one actually did these calculations in the past. It was the first time that these were carried out. Why there were not? Why was this problem before? So remember the first thing that I told you to remember. So the equations of motion for the area edge calculus give us actually that this epsilon should be zero. Okay. Now, zero would mean like, I mean, this would mean in the length edge calculus, this would mean that since it is connected directly to the curvature, this means that we don't have a curvature. We are on a flat manifold. This is not the case, though. As I said to you, like, remember, in this case, epsilon doesn't mean just curvature. It's like a mixture of curvature and a shape mismatch. So the equations of motion didn't actually mean that we're going to be to, it didn't impose flatness. But since this was thought until now, then everyone thought that the spin forms and its semi-classical limit, which is area edge, was problematic. Now, the second thing why these calculations were not done in the past is because of the, as we said, the degeneracy of the Jacobian. So if you remember, we couldn't go from one to the other, like from length variables to area variables because of the singularity of the Jacobian. So as we said, we managed to introduce a new lattice, and that's all. So, but why this was a problem? Because some people try to deform, instead of adding a vertex or using another lattice, they try to take this, the same lattice, for example, and maybe, for example, tilt it a bit. So instead of having specific vertices, they just rotate it a bit. But then when you try to bring it back to the original position, then you get some suppression of degrees of freedom. So this was not working. So these are the results, as we said. We covered GR and in the lowest order correction, a value square tensor. Sorry, value square term. Now, what is a further research on that? Since we saw that, first of all, let's see. Like, as I told you, we use the Fourier transform where we integrate out the inner vertices, the inner triangles, the inner variables. But what would happen if we actually defined the Fourier transform that included this in the result? Then there would be, for example, some additional degrees of freedom that we missed when we integrated them out. So using the already defined lattices without thinking of something new, without introducing additional vertices, for example, we are trying to find how the Fourier transform is going to be without integrated out the bulk degrees of freedom and check the consistency between the lattices, like the two lattices, you know, like keeping the variables or not. And the second thing is that since adding a vertex might be a better way to capture the degrees of freedom of the theory, what happens if we actually introduce a new lattice? So we tried actually, and we have some results on adding additional vertices. So for example, imagine we're in a 4D space. So we can actually add inner vertices to the 3D cubes or even the 2D rectangulars or even more, like to refine our lattice more and more and more. What is this going to give us in the end? Is it going to capture more of the dynamics? And then, of course, you know, having these two lattices and also the Fourier transform in a more general sense, we can actually, again, check consistency between the lattice. Like, does it give something new? Is it exactly like the previous one? Let's see. So this is what we're trying to do now. And this is the thank you slide. And yeah, this is the bibliography with some the references. Yeah, and thank you. I don't know how I am about time. Was it too fast? Okay. So please, any questions? I mean, don't pretend that you understood everything.
So Greg, you're coming from very far from gravity. It seems like on a fundamental level, maybe lengths and areas and higher dimensional generalizations should all be sort of on an equal footing. Or like, what's the meaningful, or is there a deep difference or just a calculational difference between looking at lengths and areas? Is there basic variables?
That's the thing. So there are some people in the literature that think that actually areas might be more fundamental as variables in GR than lengths. So, I mean, for example, from this, like spin forms lead directly to this area regge, like to regge calculus using areas as variables. So someone could argue that it's actually more fundamental. So there are some people that actually try to reformulate everything using areas. Let's see. Yeah, but yeah, it should be like a completely different. Like, as you see, there are some additional degrees of freedom that capture the dynamics in another way. So it should be different. It shouldn't be like that. For example, just to understand, going from the area regge axiom to the continuum limit, we don't impose any quantization anymore. It's like purely classical, right? So you see that it gives us GR plus some additional terms. So although the length regge calculus gives us just GR. So you see, like, in its sense, like area regge also captures some other dynamics that length regge does not. So it should be a different description.
When you say different description, is this different theory? Like, because you're imposing a different action, or I don't know.
Yeah.
Trying to understand why do you use the area one or the.
So, in our project, we did that because actually, like, if you find the semi-classical limit of spin form, like spin forms are well defined as the path integral of LQG. If you find the semi-classical limit, this directly goes to area regge calculus. So we don't do anything. You know, this is what gets out of the equation. So in this way, we don't really impose anything. But yeah. Does it answer the question?
Yeah, I think so.
Okay, yeah.
Can I ask a question? Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Thank you. This is Ding. I'm very interested in quantum Regi calculus. However, I work mostly with the length variables, and I find the work very interesting. The question is, I'm always curious about the possible physical differences between the two versions of quantum Regi calculus. Does your work give us any clue, say if the universe is fundamentally based on areas, what would be the phenomenological differences from a universe based on length?
That's a really nice question. It's actually part of the, like, if you, that's a small trailer for the paper that was out in March. If you read, like, the, I think it was in the paper, it was mentioned that we are trying to actually see that. So for now, as I said a bit here, we're trying to see in technical details what other dynamics we can capture. And then at some point when we finish with all of this, I probably you don't see the pointer, but when we finish with this further research, we're going to try to find the phenomenological consequences of this new theory. Like, what does this mean actually for our, for GR or for our universe or et cetera. So for now, I don't think that we have, I mean, as I told you, it was there were the first calculations that actually found a concrete result. So at least to my part, I don't have that much of intuition, but I guess that, I mean, each one of the, for sure, one of the future research points to see what this actually means for our physical world. So yeah, stay tuned, I guess. Does it answer the question?
Yes, thank you. Can I have another question?
I mean, if everyone is all right for me, yeah.
Yeah, okay. So I wonder, in the calculations, mm-hmm. I'm not sure if they're perturbative or non-perturbative. I wonder if at any point you needed to deal with the light cone constraints, like one at each point of the configuration, there are two light cones in the bulk.
Okay, let me think about it. So light cones, actually, I think for now it's in a, I mean, for now, the background geometry is given by a flat Euclidean for this space. So does this answer the question? I mean, should there be a light cone in a Euclidean space?
Oh, I see. You're doing things in Euclidean even.
Yeah, for now, yeah.
Okay, then it's a meaningless question because there's no causal structure.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
For now, everything is here.
Actually, then that leads to another question. Well, it's Euclidean. Do I believe the same results hold in the Lorentzian?
Yeah, that's, I'm not sure too. It's for sure a concrete step, but we would need to see that. I mean, it's a bit, as you said, like you need to think of really different things when you try to do that in a Lorentzian case. So I don't really have an intuition, to be honest, on that.
Okay. I guess there works to be done.
Yeah, there's like, it was the first year, like actually the first 6 months. So I think I can have quite some hard time in the future.
Yeah. What you have is already very encouraging.
Yeah, indeed. And for the first calculation, yeah, it was, yeah. So there is one more question. So, yeah.
It's more a comment to take. First of all, I think because you get Einstein and Wilder, the logical implications with the Einstein bigravity in the first place. And I think there are recently some circles of people deriving the black hole solutions. So with that regard. And I think the other thing is, because as I said, we're also working from the continuum. In that case, it would be just a change of age from SO4 to SO3-1, which would give you the Lorentzian case. And I think this would just change imposing a reality condition on the objects that you're working with. So it might be possible to get a similar conclusion that you get a vice square term starting maybe if it would be possible to do that on the not just now. Also, maybe you're out of the same.
Yeah.
Okay. If there is no more questions, since I'm also going to talk, And let's welcome Ninja for the next talk.
Yeah.